Now on 94.7 The Pulse, the weekly wrap-up and word on the street. This is 11 on Friday.
It's good morning to Victor Bongiorno, who's with me in the studio. How are you, Vic?
Good morning, Mitchell. Good to be here.
And sadly, Liz is not with us today.
Not in today, and we're going to miss her.
We are, and we hope that she's feeling better, or at least maybe this radio program will bring her some relief and not exacerbate
the problem.
The problem. Also, she got her pool put in last week, so maybe she's called in sick to go and sit by that.
That's the reason. Well spotted.
The weather at the moment is great pool weather, but I do see that this afternoon there is a possible storm coming through.
Yep.
And even there was an alert that came through on my phone for thunderstorm asthma.
Yeah, there's a, you know, I often hear those alerts and I wonder how long this has been a problem. Is it a recent phenomenon or is it...
We had a guy on a few weeks back talking about it. It was a big event in, was it 2016 or 2015?
Yes.
And that caught a lot of people by surprise. Mm. So it must have been a very recent thing. And now they talk a lot more about it because the risk is quite severe. Because people that may not have suffered from asthma before could be out in this thunderstorm and it could actually bring about asthma symptoms and they don't have a puffer with them or anything. So it's actually quite a severe situation.
Well, look, it is self-assessment and self-care to a degree, but along those lines, I see that there's a move to remove the lovely plane trees of Melbourne.
Mm.
Now, I don't know. How do you feel about that? Is it going to fix the problem? And, you know, are we just trying to create a policy that's looks to be doing something? Is the problem increasing? I mean, how critical are these trees? They're a beautiful part of Melbourne. I'd be very careful about making that. How many people have suffered inordinately because of those trees? You know, the people dropping dead. I mean, I don't want to be too lighthearted about this, but they are a beautiful part of Melbourne. I'm not so sure it's a good policy.
The grass pollen's getting kicked up is what's the problem. And according to the guy that we had on from the university talking about it, the grass pollen is at record highs because of the recent rainfall that we had in sort of late winter there. So I don't really think the trees necessarily have that much to do with it. I think it's just a big problem across the board just because of all the grass pollens and things in the air. I'm not sure. But look, one of the things I love about Melbourne is all the historical trees. You go down those tree-lined streets and the established trees.
A big part of Melbourne. Yeah. A big part of Melbourne.
So you can't just make a decision to rip up 100-year-old trees lightly.
Well, they have made that decision, apparently.
Yeah.
And there might be some more to be said about that. But, I mean, it'd be a terrible situation if we pulled the trees out and still had the problem, which is there's every chance we will.
Well, I would have thought so, because I think some trees probably doesn't make a big difference. It's, I think, the bigger picture, which is all this grass pollen that gets swept up in thunderstorms. And I mean, it's always a very rare set of conditions. I think it's got to be sort of just right for this thunderstorm asthma to be a problem. Like, you know, it's got to be coming from the right direction and sort of a perfect storm of events, if you like. But when it happens, it's quite severe and people have to be hospitalized. So yeah, I wouldn't be ripping up trees lightly, but yeah, if you do suffer from asthma symptoms, maybe just be careful this afternoon. But that said, we have received weather alerts in the past that have amounted to nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you looked out there now, you wouldn't say that there's a thunderstorm brewing.
You know what? It's funny, because yesterday I was down at Apollo Bay and I blow a dog off a chain. Mm. And I came back last night and I rang Jack down there this morning and it's blowing like anything again. So
it's coming up this way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it does feel like when it gets really hot and humid, I think that's thunderstorm weather, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we're in for a front. Yeah.
Yeah, well, actually, there is a front coming through. I do know that the overnight low is 20 degrees overnight, and then it's going to... 15 degrees overnight, and then for tomorrow it looks like it's going to... 15 degrees means the cool change will be coming through probably later today.
It's quite a deep low, 959, it's quite deep low.
Yeah, right.
And well-formed.
I was down at the Geelong waterfront yesterday for the launch of Geelong Monopoly.
Oh, okay. What's that? Explain.
So it's a new game board, which is it's been released by a company that's got the license from the original Monopoly people. And instead of going around, you know, Park Lane and all those London streets, Mayfair, Oxford, you go through Geelong landmarks and you get to buy things like the Geelong waterfront and the Yu Yangs. So I was down there yesterday. They had this big game board set up outside the carousel and the mayor was there. But talking about wind, it wasn't the best location for a media conference, because we nearly got blown away. And the mayor's in the paper today, and I'm amazed that they managed to get the right photo with the hair out of her face, because it was so windy. It was really hard to get the right shot.
And that's the first time you've met her?
No. She used to come in on my program every week. Back when I first started in 2014, and we didn't have a lot of regular guests, she was one of the people that I approached, because I thought she's a bit of a mover and a shaker in the Geelong region. She'd run as an independent candidate a couple of times, run for mayor unsuccessfully. So I said, come on, and we met up and had a chat, and she said if it's going to be worthwhile doing it, would be worthwhile only coming on once a week, so having some frequency. So for about 2 years, she'd come into the studio every week and we'd talk about the issues of the day, a bit like what we're doing now, and then she had to go away and write a book about Susan Alberti, and now she's back. So I know her very well, actually. I had a good chat with her down there yesterday, and she's actually increasing the frequency, because the mayor would come on my show once a month, and now she's increasing that to fortnightly, where the mayor will come on. So that's actually really good, because we get more long-form opportunities to sit down with the mayor of Geelong and try and work out the strategic direction of the city. So every fortnight, I think that's going to be quite good.
Well, you know, traditionally, the mayor of Geelong is an untouchable figure. You don't sort of have much interchange, do you? But this will change that, won't it?
I hope so. And to go down there yesterday, and she was just there amongst everyone else, and we just had a good chat. And, yeah, I think she comes across as very down-to-earth in person. Well, but maybe that's just because I've known her for so long and she used to come in here every week. Maybe it's had that effect. But, no, I think she'll be good. But, of course, the proof will be in the pudding.
Well, look, there are some terrific ladies on the political stage at the moment who are forefronting, and you know, let's just hope that she's the same. And it's possible she is very much down to earth. We do get a lot of you know, opinionated you know, leaders, and that's something we just don't need now.
Well, that's true. I mean, people have to be real. Like, I don't mind people that are opinionated, but there's people that I think are opinionated, but it's sort of grounded in theory. It's not opinions derived from the fact that they've been out there.
Yeah.
Or untouchable. That's true. They're above everyone else. Whereas there's people that have opinions because they've been there and done that, and they've been in the trenches, and they tend to be the people that I admire.
Very much so, yeah. I agree.
Speaking of which, the and I know that you're perhaps not too keen to bring this up just because it's been done to death in the media, but just the protests that we saw in Melbourne, I just didn't like that. I don't like seeing violence on our streets, and I just didn't like the clash between the police and the protesters. But this is a bunch of people calling for a socialist revolution.
And that's it, isn't it? I just don't see that there's any answers with that. And when you said I wasn't too keen, I am keen. I just don't know what's going to be achieved by a discussion about it. There's a lot of frustration out there in the community. No one denies their right to protest. But to obstruct, that's something else. And look, there's possibly going to be harder legislation formed as a result of this. We all concede that there is an issue here. But, you know, why just take everyone down with you? And that's just why I think giving them oxygen is probably a little bit of a...
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. I bring them up because I see this program now as a bit of catharsis. Sometimes if there's issues that have particularly ticked me off during the week, I like to come here and vent.
I agree.
On a Friday, and I enjoy doing that a lot. And, look, it really just frustrated me watching what was going on, and I just hate this sort of mob rule, you know, the violence, settling things through violence. I'd much rather that one of the mining protesters came in here and sat at the microphone and we could have a chat for a while, and a debate and a respectful discussion, rather than people punching police horses and spitting at people going into a meeting, etc.
Absolutely. And I'd like to know what's their answer? What are they suggesting? Other than violence.
Well, this is the problem when these protests form, because obviously they've got sort of one central organiser or an organising committee that has one narrative, but then all these fringe groups start to join the protest, and then that narrative becomes increasingly diluted. So the main people joining the protest, from the spokespeople that I've heard speaking in the media, have said, well, we think mining has to continue, because otherwise how would we have things like mobile phones, which they all use in spades?
Or you know, national income.
Exactly, an economy.
Just an economy, you know.
So they say, you know, we still want mining, it just has to be a bit more accountable. You know, we don't like what they're doing with some of the environmental aspects. We don't like what they're doing with some of the land rights of Aboriginal people. And a lot of people would look at that and say, yeah, that's maybe reasonable. But then you go out to the people that come in and say, no, we don't want capitalism anymore.
Well, at what point are we going to say no? I see that the Prime Minister is very critical about certain companies withholding from the Adani scheme.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's their right to do that, I would assume. Who knows where a legal case could spring from? But I believe it. You know, if they've got concerns and if they've got economic concerns or ethical concerns, they can withhold, and that's what's happened here.
Mm.
So that's a form of protest. But you know, mining is very much in the spotlight. I was listening to the mining of lithium there in the Andes, and there were a few indigenous people there. The Andean people were talking, and with some authority, and very, you know, they were very much putting their argument towards the fact that the mining was interrupting their lifestyle to the point where they were flushing a lot of this lithium out of the ground. And I'm getting to a point here. They were flushing a lot of lithium out of the ground for the batteries.
Yeah, okay? And without lithium, we don't have batteries, right?
But guess what? Their wells have all gone dry. So it brings a point, you know, how viable a certain mining techniques in the society and in the world, and Adani's part of that too. Mm. Water is a huge issue at the moment, you know. So they have a point, but they should debate it.
Well, mining's not untouchable, and that's the point. We can scrutinise mining, but the issue, of course, is once all these fringe groups jump in, no one really knows what's going on down there. So you've got people looking at it from the climate change angle, then you've got people looking at it from like the angle that you've mentioned there, and it dilutes it down. It means you can't have a sensible discussion. And really, I think the only thing that works out of these big protests is when everyone unites around like a three-word slogan or something, and you just have that one slogan, because
that's it.
You can't actually have an in-depth, nuanced discussion, which is what programs like this program try and do, because we sit here for an hour and try and actually go into some detail.
Well, we've got to avoid being called climate deniers here, because we're actually discussing something. You know, that's the big trap, and that's what does happen.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's just stupid. I mean,
it is stupid.
That's just labelling people.
And that's part of the rationale. That's part of the way they move. And that can't be supported. No.
Well, mining has the solutions to climate change, doesn't it? If we want to have materials going into renewable energy, because solar panels, they have materials in them that are heavily reliant on mining, as are the batteries in electric cars. So where do you draw the line?
I personally part ways with electric cars. I don't think they're a solution at all. I think they're going to take too much of a toll on the environment, but that's just a debate that should be had.
I'm skeptical about them just because, yeah, you're right. Once these batteries all run out, what happens to them?
Where do they go?
I know. Well, exactly. Can you imagine, like, dumping all these batteries out of...
Every 10 or 12 years.
Yeah. That said, I do think a lot of the components can be recycled, but obviously that 1% that can't be recycled are very toxic and are quite detrimental to the environment. So what ends up happening with all these things, whether it's mining or electric cars, is it starts to get to the point of competing priorities. What do you value more?
Well, you know what? If you want to just paraphrase this, it's a growing frustration in the community.
Mm.
People really don't know how to express themselves, including these protesters, I would suggest. And this is just coming out in this way. They can't get involved structurally in a debate for whatever reason, and they are just totally frustrated. Now, you see that at all. You know, you see that in China politically. You see it in Russia. And you're seeing it here now, you know, starting to pop up now. People are totally frustrated with what's happening in the environment and the economy.
Well, I was watching one of the protesters. It's funny you mentioned that. And I just thought, watching this person on TV, a bit of media training wouldn't have gone astray, because the person was on camera but wasn't looking down the barrel of the camera. You know, when you do those TV interviews where the person's in the studio,
yep,
and the person... person's out in the field.
Yep.
You've got to look down the camera, otherwise it doesn't look like you're giving eye contact to the audience,
well,
which instantly means that people feel that your message is less credible. And the person was swaying on the spot, which also you shouldn't be doing because that's very distracting from the message. So, yeah, a bit of media training and they probably would have got the message out there a lot more effectively.
Well, it's the same thing in life. If you're speaking to someone who's not looking at you and looking the other way while they're dressing, you know, it has caused me in the past to say, excuse me, we need to change the tone of this conversation. I'm not getting the right vibes here. You're not looking at me and I need to talk.
The one exception to that is in a radio studio where quite often there's other things to look at and we have our notes and the listeners out there in listener land don't need to know that.
Oh, no, we're omnipotent. No, we're not. It doesn't
matter. And by the way, if anyone wants to ring in, please feel free, 5225947. If you disagree with what we're saying or even... shock horror if you actually agree with what we're saying. I wish Liz were here because I think she would have an interesting perspective.
A very moderating force, Liz. She pulls me up at the by the bit. Yeah.
Speaking of that, that's a horse reference.
It is a horse reference, and we should be talking about that. It's a subject close to my heart, and I do have a friend of mine. I'd like to ring and have a general chat with him. He's a man of enormous exposure to the industry. He's been a farrier all his life, and has run by appointment to Suharto and in Indonesia and to the Packer stables, and is still going in his 70s. He's still got a team of farriers named John Pittard, and he's also owned a lot of prize-winning horses, including Pluto Mio in the Olympics just gone. It was an equestrian horse.
Well, the question for him would be, did he know what was going on? Because
he's got a lot of opinions. We might even have to shut him down. But John, we'll give him a call in a sec.
Yeah. But look, the latest development on this, just before we get to that, is that Racing Victoria has announced a $25 million fund, and the money's going to come out of people's tickets and I think all aspects of income coming into racing to facilitate horses' retirement. I think the bottom line is it remains to be seen where the money will ultimately end up, and big amounts of money like this are often bad at actually getting through to the targets where they're needed.
The point of it is, Mitchell, that's welcome. $25 million is a good starting point. This industry is awash with money at the high end, not at the low end. So we've got to be careful not to punish the little trainer that's doing his best and the battler. That's part of the Australian psyche we don't want to hurt. Mm. But do you know that $25 million fund, it's very impressive that... this money's been put forward, but you know what? It's more of a reaction than an action. I mean, they were caught out. They were caught red-handed. And you can just imagine the instruction to get out there and be seen to be throwing a lot of money at this to try and allay the fears prior to the spring racing carnival. I'm a little bit cynical about this. One good thing that was said is the control of euthanizing horses, because what we saw on that footage was totally unacceptable. And I'd really like to know, where was the RSPCA with all this? Where were they? I mean, this is not. It's well known in the industry. How come it's taken so long for this footage to come out? And I, like probably everyone else listening, have had great days at the races, including the Cup.
Yeah,
and the car park, but you just trust that the right thing is being done. Like when you get on a jet, you trust that the pilot knows how to fly. And the exposure now of this particular problem is going to have enormous consequences for the industry, and it could lead to the full restructuring of the industry, because there are some glaring facts, the elephants in the room here, that we'll talk about in a minute.
We'll take a break and we'll get your friend on the line who has some expertise, and I'm looking forward to hearing what the story is firsthand on the ground. But for me, I've said this so much, but the simple solution, your National Horses Register, full transparency so that we know as punters what percentage of horses get successfully rehomed and what percentage are sent straight to abattoir. I think that's the answer. Well, transparency, and then people based on that information can decide whether they want to keep supporting racing or not, and that's the only way you'll stop it.
Well, think face value, that's a good suggestion, but let's talk about that particular idea in depth when we come back.
Take a break.
Until midday, you're listening to 11 on Friday on 94.7 The Pulse.
I've just had another ping on my phone. A severe weather warning has been issued for parts of central and eastern Victoria, which includes us, including Melbourne. Heavy rain and damaging winds are possible on Saturday. Tomorrow sounds like it's going to be a pretty terrible day weather-wise, Vic.
Well, look, it's nice to hear the word rain, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But sometimes it can be damaging, and we see it, you know, if it's going to be the order of the day, we've got to have to change our lifestyles, probably, that damaging rain.
Also, we're not doing too badly here in terms of rain, are we? It's more in the drought-affected areas, where down here we've actually done all right, I think, out of winter.
Oh, God, look, Mitchell, the other day I went from the 12 Apostles into Colac to refuel, and I had the mayor of Kalgoorlie on.
Yeah.
And he was just blown away. He said, I can't believe it. He said, look at this green. Look at these dams. They're all
exactly.
full. We are blessed here.
We are.
This corner of the world is just
wonderful. And last I
wonderful.
Checked, our water storages were at 70%, which,
given the circumstances, is terrific.
A lot of places would kill for that. Now, we've got a friend of yours on the line who's going to give us a bit of first-hand knowledge as to what's going on with horses, because he is a horseman.
John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Now, hang on, John, I think I've got you turned down there.
I can hear you. John, how are you? And you're out and about today?
Yes, I am. I'm actually on the Western Ring Road heading to Mobbs Creek.
Oh, yeah, got you now, John. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's good. John, thanks for coming on. Just to start, can you just give us an outline of how long you've been in the industry and what you do?
Well, I'm 74. I've been a farrier for 61 years.
Righto. And some of those, some of the connections have been with distinction. Can you explain a bit there?
Oh, I'm basically now a stud farrier. I do a lot of work on some of the major horse studs. And
You had connections in Indonesia, though, didn't you, at some stage?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. I lived there for 8 years.
Yeah, righto. And you handle some pretty important stables there. And back here in Australia, what some of the names?
Oh, I do, you know, Godolphin, Glenelg, Shadow Hill, you know, a lot of the, you know, really well-respected horse stuff.
Yeah, so you've been around, and you're also a horse owner, John.
Yes, I am. Bred horses, raced horses, had eventing horses. We had one go to the World Equestrian Games in France, won the Olympics in Rennes.
Who was that? Explain who that was.
Pluto Mio. This is a horse that we bred, or my wife bred, and probably one of the best eventers Australia has ever seen.
Just give us an outline of the horse itself. Gelding?
He's gelding. He's now 22-year-old. He's 17-2 and just a magnificent animal.
And so now, where's he at the moment, at 22?
He's up in New South Wales with the Tinnies and... He's basically competing now, but still competing because he doesn't like being in the paddock as just a retired horse.
What's the indications that would tell you he doesn't like being in the paddock?
Oh, he's just unsettled all the time, and, you know, when the other horses are being ridden and what have you, he's, you know, just gets himself stirred up. But he just loves competing, and he's not competing at a high level now. He was competing on the world stage. Now he's back to Pony Club.
Well, none of us like that. But you'd probably say, just from what you said, you could probably say this horse has demands that are being met because they've got caring owners, right? It's got specific demands that just part of its old age, but it's not being they're still being looked after, and diet wise.
Oh, no, well, he is an extreme. He is a very expensive horse to maintain because he has a syndrome called PSSM, and it's a potassium imbalance, so he has to have filtered water. We had to buy a reverse osmosis machine to filter the water, got to wash his hay. So he's a very high-maintenance horse.
He's the celiac of horses, by the sound of it.
Pretty much, I'd say.
Yeah, well, good on you, and it's terrific to see that there's a safety net for him. Now, unfortunately, that's not the case with a lot of thoroughbreds. What's your take on, well, I mean, that's a big question. It's probably too broad a question. But in encapsulating it, what would you think the racing authority should do with as a result of the recent expose on the thoroughbreds? Have you got any...
I don't believe it's the racing authority as such. It's more like the stud book. I mean, we are breeding possibly too many horses. It's very, very difficult to get into sales now because there are just so many to choose from, so many horses to choose from. So not every thoroughbred that is born is going to make a successful racehorse.
So thoroughbreds, by their very distinction, that they are a high maintenance horse. Would you agree with that?
Look, high maintenance and high spirited.
Yeah.
So every thoroughbred that's born, or thoroughbreds, not everyone's going to make the kids pony.
No. Well, that's a really important point you make. It's a really important point, and that's probably the crux of the problem here. Back in the early 1900s, when a horse came out of racing, it had a value. And you know, it was probably punted around for quite some time for working, until it was very obvious that it wasn't going to make the grade or it was dangerous. This day and age, it's generated the interest or the non-interest is generated by the accounting people, and that is concerning at my level. I find that very concerning about horses. You know, it's the accounting side of things has had a bad history in our country. And look, something made me arc up about this story. And often in life, you don't know what makes you so angry. You give a response, and you think, "Well, why did I do that? What made me do that?" For me personally, I hold a special place in my heart for the horses of the First World War, and it's not too long a bow to draw that were deemed too expensive to bring back. Now, do you know how many horses went to the First World War campaign?
Northern
deserts and the European campaign. Now, these were the best horses that Australia had to offer. They were termed whalers, but that's a general term.
Yep.
You know how many horses went?
No idea.
No.
Well,
no, I don't
well.
Know how many? But I tell you what, I've just read the book, The Bastard, from Bill the Bastard.
All right, we'll talk about that in a minute, but 136,000 horses went from Australia.
And most of them came out of the Hunter Valley.
136,000, they went all around the east side and also Western Australia. They 136,000, and they performed with distinction. Some of them could have, you know, had the VC awarded. The horses that charged in the Beersheba campaign went 4 days without water to make that charge across sand. Now, their thank you for that was a bullet. Do you know how many came back? One horse out of 136,000. Because the people in Australia... So it was possible to bring them back. The people in Australia said, too hard. It's not too hard to take them there. And that's what we've got here now. We've got a situation where it's too hard. Now, not only is it too hard, we're breeding too many. You touched on it before. And I believe that there's probably got to be a huge restructure in this whole industry. Is it the question's got to be posed? Is it unviable in its current form, given the publicity now? 25 million thrown at it is lip service, as far as I'm concerned, because there's no definite idea of how that's going to be allocated or where it's going to be used. It was important to note that they did say the proper euthanising of horses on property would be a factor henceforth, and I think that's really critical. I don't think any of us want to see the reproduction of the debacle we saw with those horses in the yards being euthanized. And look, the actual act of euthanization wasn't in contest for me, but it was all the lead up to and some of those were stakeholders. They were big ticket winners, and suddenly they'd outlived their usefulness, and they had to go to be slaughtered. Now, not all of them were dangerous, and we had testimony from people who saw those brands and said that horse was a very quiet horse. I was appalled to see it on television getting euthanized like that. It's an indictment on us as Australians, just like it was in the First World War. You know, I carry that flag, and for those people and for those troopers who had to shoot their horses, and you couldn't have you just could not equate the emotional trauma for those people. They would never have got over that. And some of the indignity that had to occur there, and this is because, again, I'll go back to it, the bean counter said no. They had to shave their horse's tail and their mane because that commodity was highly prized over there, and lead them out in the desert and shoot them. Now, you know, at some stage we're asking horses to have a huge heart. They're all our mates when they're running down the straight. They're all our mates when they're running down the straight. But when the race is over and they're not first, and they are running for their life, when the race is over and they're not first, you know, the deal's off. They're no longer our mate. It's the antithesis of mateship. To me, this what's happening now is the antithesis of mateship. And we've created this environment by, as you said, breeding too many horses. You know, it's an interesting point you make that they can't even get into the amount of horses to find. You know, it's hard to get a horse. What was the term you used? Up and running? What did you say? In the auctions?
Well, getting them, like even when breeding young horses, getting them into a task on itself.
Yeah, right.
I mean, what you've got to realise too, Vic, the ownership of horses has changed over the years. I mean, today it's a lot of syndicates. It's so expensive to race a horse.
Yep.
And you'll find that it's fairly common to everybody will take 10% in a horse.
Yep.
And they're syndicates.
Yep.
Mostly syndicates. Now, a lot of those people in those syndicates, they have no emotion. They have no emotional involvement with the horse. And that is, you know, it's like it's just a figure on a piece of paper. And, you know, you won't have 10 people go to the races to watch that horse run.
That in itself is quite a stark fact. It's a little bit sad to hear that, you know, because we are talking about an extremely intelligent animal with a big heart that is in a controlled environment where they've got studs, trainers, strappers, people, general bods that love them. The owners come in, they love them. And all of a sudden, no one loves them. Now, they can be problem horses, and no one is suggesting that they should try to be rehoused. But I have heard it said that horses in the racing fraternity have to be trained in a certain way so as probably, you know, they're not going to be dysfunctional at the end of their career. I don't know whether that's a practical suggestion or not. But,
the question I would ask too, Vic, does people know how much it costs to have a horse trained?
Oh, it'd be a large ticket. It'd be a big ticket.
It would cost a minimum of $25,000 a year to
yep.
have a horse in training.
Yep.
That's with the training and then, you know, spelling in between. Now, when a horse is retired, like, if you want to be the, you know, the do-gooder and the lover of the horse and you put it on an adjustment property, that's going to cost you about $25 a day.
Yep.
That's the cost.
Yep.
You can't have a big paddock and throw 100 horses out in the paddock and think they're going to all live happily ever after together. That's not the real world.
Doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way.
No.
It costs money. Who's going to pay? And not all horses, you know, are good in a herd. You'll get the, you know, the dominant one and belt the other horse up. There's, you know, the hoof care. There's a veterinary expense.
Yeah, good points. Yeah.
There's a lot of money involved.
So that's exactly right. Take the point, and just like the First World War, horses, and you said it yourself, a horse is the hardest thing to give away because people are suspicious if you've got a horse to give away, even if they've got the room and the feed these days. But, you know, because it could have behavioural problems. You know, I don't know how this is going to be fleshed out. I don't know where it's going to end up. But the problem...
I wouldn't be using, like, the First World War is an exception as far as those horses being shot. Those horses were put down because the people that had them, the soldiers that had loved their horses. Their horses, a lot of times, saved their lives. They didn't
yep.
want to leave them behind to be mistreated by the Egyptians and the Arabs and what have you, who would never look after them the same way. And that was a love killing for them rather than no, we just slaughter them, we're not bringing them back to Australia.
I fully agree with that. I fully agree with that, and that was the manly choice for them to do. They had the choice of leaving them alive or shooting them. Well, they did the right thing, a lot of them. But the fact of the matter is, what the point I clearly make is, why couldn't the same support be given to those animals who performed with great distinction to bring them home, to bring a lot of them home, if not all of them home, rather than let them languish over there? I mean, it's a huge betrayal of trust. It's a huge... And what we're seeing now is a betrayal of trust too. The system is very top-heavy from the way I see it. There is a byproduct happening out of the racing industry, and that is thoroughbreds that are unhomable. Now, there are a lot of industries with a byproduct that have to take control of their byproduct, uranium industry, the plastics industry, and dare I say it, the thoroughbred industry have to take control of these horses that are unhomable. How it's going to be done is a matter for debate. I don't know. I wouldn't pretend to solve it here, but perhaps they talk about traceability. Is that still going to add up to, you know, acceptance of responsibility? I don't know. But
the sad part about this whole exercise at the moment and what's happening is being directed at the thoroughbred industry. That's not the only equine industry that's operating. You've got your trotters, you've got your pleasure horses,
sure.
You've got your hornbloods. I mean, the only reason they've attacked the thoroughbred industry because every thoroughbred is microchipped and branded, so they can just take a photo of it and say, bang, there's a brand, that's the horse, that's who that is.
Yep.
So, you know, don't just single out the thoroughbred.
No, I don't think we are. I don't think we are, but thoroughbreds, I mean, this is probably, it's probably exposed the problem at the pointy end.
Have you ever been to an abattoir's? Like an acre?
Yeah, I did. I worked at an abattoir's for a while, yeah.
Well, the most disgusting places you can go to. I can't stand going there. But,
yep.
You know, I have been there, and I've been to abattoir's in Indonesia.
Yep.
So, you know, I know it, and they're the most horrible places
sure.
You could ever go. And the lot of those people that are working there, they have no emotion towards the horse.
Sure.
Or the
we've seen that.
Yeah.
Yep, and that's probably the point that perhaps a humane response to the ending of their lives could be floated, and being dropped on the property could be the solution here. I'm a practical person. I don't, unless the horse has got some particular emotional tie or is a huge stake winner. I do believe that there is use of the meat. I don't particularly think that it's two wrongs don't make a right. If the horse is going to be euthanized, then that's fine. Do it. But don't turn your back on the practical aspects of this. But I'm just saying, I don't want to see that sort of panic in horses' eyes. I just don't like seeing it in any animal's eyes. And look, it raises the question, are our abattoirs in for a big revamp? There are people that specialise in this, and it's not just horses, it's general question. As you said, you see, and I don't want to inflame this too much, but you see that they are impractical when it comes to the animal themselves. And the people that work in there could do with some counselling.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I agree with that 100%.
Well, John, getting the wind-up here, and I appreciate your time.
No worries at all, Vic, any time.
Well, we'll catch up one day, and I know, John, that you've been seen to have the odd beer and as a result of a race, and maybe that'll happen again one day, I don't know. But look, John, just between you and I, I'd like to dedicate this show to Helen Packer and her memory. Rest in peace, Helen.
Oh, Vic. You'll get me emotional now.
Yeah. I know she was a great friend of yours, John. Okay, mate.
Thanks, John.
Cheers, mate. Bye.
Now, we had someone call in to speak to us, and I'm not sure if they didn't actually catch her name at reception. She may not be on the line anymore because she was on hold for a fair while. Are you still with us? Hello? Hello, are you there?
I am.
Oh, sorry. Hello, what was your name, sorry?
Rebecca.
Rebecca. Now, what did you want to speak to us about?
Look, it's a very interesting topic, but I've got a couple of points, and it sort of ends with a question which is open-ended, and I'm interested to hear what you got to say, but I think with respect to the horses and the treatment of horses, it's a symptom of a larger problem that we've got, which is the commodification of animals across all sectors, and by extension of that, people as well. So people have now become, animals have become, and people are becoming commodities to be exploited. And that leads into the gambling, and the gambling industry and the betting industry and the incessant promotion of betting feeds that industry and its insatiable appetite for money, which all leads in and feeds into big business and publicly listed companies. They're the ones that win. Now, that's one point. The second point is nobody wants to see any animal treated like those horses were treated.
Mm.
I think we would all agree with that. We get emotional because we all love horses, or most of us love horses. We see them as very intelligent. They're no more intelligent than a cow. A cow shouldn't be treated like that either. No animal should be treated like that. So there needs to be a mandate, and it comes down to humanity. And in some ways we're all complicit because we do bet on the races. We enjoy to, you know, enjoy going and putting on a dress and going along. So I think it's something we all have to address.
Well, we can all put on a dress. I mean, there's no barriers there. But the fact is that I agree with the word commodification. What did you say? What is it?
Commodification.
Commodification. It's exactly. It probably encapsulates everything. And you know, but there is something that I wouldn't want to lose on the day. Is the spirited rush down the track, the beautiful thrust of a horse just running its heart out down the track, that I wouldn't want to lose on the day. Is the spirited rush down the track, the beautiful thrust of a horse just running its heart out down the track?
No, I'm not in the camp of prohibition of anything, but I am in the camp of regulation. And I don't know the figures because I don't really care to examine it that much, but I would love to know what the revenue from betting and gambling is to the government, state and national. And I'd
good
like
point.
To see some of that money funnel towards repatriation of horses, race horses, because let's face it, that they're operating, I don't know what the percentage is, but it would be a very, very small percentage of horses that are bred for racing that actually make it to the big time. So we're talking about a large number of beautiful animals, intelligent, beautiful, majestic animals that need to be cared for. And some of that money, that vast pot of money that is going to the government, the revenue from gambling needs to be reappropriated.
You know, you probably wouldn't get them to the table on that. They'd be very reticent to sort of sit down and talk about that. But the fact of the matter is, and we'll just touch on this briefly, that a lot of these horses are... They do have behavioural problems that are dangerous. Now, we can't shy away from that, but that makes them a special case. They have to be handled, you know, correctly. They can't just be pushed through yards and treated the way they were treated. The industry has got a lot of hurdles, if you can use that phrase. And I think that the points you raise are really valid, Rebecca, so that's handy.
Just for my own curiosity, whereabouts are you listening to us from today?
Richmond, sunny Richmond.
Well, thank you very much for tuning in.
Pleasure. Thank you,
Rebecca.
The discussion. It's been great.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, bye.
Well, there you go. And if anyone else wants to chime in, give us a call, 5222 5947. We're always happy to have a discussion with our listeners because it adds a lot of interest and colour and movement to our program. We have to take another break, but I'd be very keen, Vic, to get your perspective on this Qantas situation. Three jets, we think, grounded now with cracks in a part that I wasn't familiar with as a part, because I've never flown jets, but maybe you know more about it than me.
We'll put it this way, just briefly, it's the bit where the wing attaches.
Yep. Take a break.
There's more to know about our region. 94.7 The Pulse.
11:58, and isn't that Subscribe-a-thon promo that we just played there good? They were two students in my Intro to Broadcasting class, which another one is about to start up this month, and one of the units or one of the assignments we get them to do is to make a 30-second promo, and that's what they created.
Well, that was quite good, I thought. Yeah.
Very talented. Now, this Qantas, what part of the plane was it that was actually affected? I mean, I know it's the part that holds up the wing, but it was a weird name, the something fork.
Pickle fork.
Mm. I've never heard of that.
No, I haven't either.
Before.
And it's not the sort of thing that, you know, as I said before, when you get on a plane, it's trust, isn't it? that you trust that the engineers are doing their job, the designers have done their job, the pilots are doing their job, and the management are doing their job. It's total trust.
And also, I suppose, that the regulator is doing its job, CASA, in offering some oversight.
Look, CASA are there. They're there in big, you know, with a lot of force on things like this, and I think they've probably made the right decision. The thing to be aware of, and if you've been around aircraft, that all these things are part of a maintenance, you know, survey. And cracks are, it sounds terrible, they're a part of life in aircraft. Mm. Now, cracks can appear and don't ground an aircraft, but they can, you know, they'll be brought to the organisation's notice and say, well, we've got a crack appearing here, we're monitoring it under the specifications from the manufacturer. We're allowed it to do this and that before we have to ground the plane, and then we'll have to take decisive action. So all these things are manageable, and those cracks, I'm sure, are manageable by Qantas. And CASA, the regulator, would take a very dim view of anything else. But, you know, it must be pointed out that it's quite a difficult relationship between Labor, the hire of Labor in Qantas, and the management.
Yeah, so this is when Steve Pavinas comes out and says you should ground the entire 737 fleet?
Well, you know, there's a lot of emotion, like a previous subject, running around this particular point. But I would trust that our engineers and our regulator and Qantas management and Boeing are making the right decision in the long term. And these cracks that have been found, are they going to ground those aircraft? I don't know.
Well, I think, as you say, cracks can be safe. I've watched I watched a documentary, I think it might have been an air crash investigation, about a plane that crashed because of a crack. But that was because it wasn't managed and got out of hand. But you can have small cracks, and it's okay, as long as you say, they're monitoring it and they know where it is, etc. But you mentioned the name Boeing. That doesn't necessarily have the greatest amount of respect and trust in the industry, and in fact more broadly at the moment. Neither does the 737, even though these aircraft aren't part of the 737 MAX and were made probably a long time ago.
Certainly separate from the MAX for a lot of reasons. They're completely different design. This is a completely different, for all intentions and purposes, it's a completely different aircraft, even though they both bear the 737 name. Now, that's not a totally qualified view, but it's someone who's in the industry, and The MAX suffers from a huge problem, a mismanagement at the core, and again, the accountants who were pushing that aircraft out the door too early for certification to try and beat the Airbus equivalent, and what did it lead to? And then they made a subsequent failure of judgment, an error in judgment, to let it keep flying. So Boeing do bear a lot of responsibility in this. It could even change the whole structure of Boeing. Even if those aircraft come back online, which they're saying at the end of the year, will it mean that the public are going to accept those aircraft? I dare not, unless they're going to fork them out to some countries that don't care. You know, big problem for Boeing. But in this particular case, it wouldn't stop me from jumping on a Virgin or a Qantas flight. These guys are...
And 737s are the backbone of those fleets, aren't they?
Yeah, and look, they'll be right on this. They'll be white on rice with all this particular talk. They're not going to be sitting on their laurels. I assume that their decisions are competent. And look, with respect to our labour force here in Australia, we all just got to get on with it now, rather than you know, be too emotional about the fact that there is a crack appearing. So what will happen in the long term? I suppose there'll be more on the news about that tonight, but I'm not an engineer. I'm only... Yeah, I am in the industry, but I'm not an engineer.
We'll wait and see. But yeah, I do actually have trust. I wouldn't hesitate to get on a Boeing 737. Maybe not the MAX just at the moment, but the 800
definitely not
and the
MAX.
900, I'm sure, is fine. One thing I wanted to mention before we wrap up was just something that captured my thinking a little bit, and I do use this program as a bit of catharsis, and it was on Monday, and I was on from 3 till 4, as I always am. And the lead story of our 3 o'clock news and our 4 o'clock news on Monday was... the Labour Party, the opposition, is criticising the government for not turning up to
the ceremonies to mark the end of climbing Uluru, and they had all their Labour people there, and they were criticising the government, and apparently the Prime Minister was quote-unquote slammed by one of the Labour senators, Pat Dodson. And probably they should have been there, but if that's the lead news story, and also that is the main ammunition that the opposition has against the government, which is you didn't turn up to an event, well, what's going on with accountable government in Australia?
I think the Prime Minister's probably got a lot of important issues at the moment, and look, he's validated the fact that it's got to stop. We don't want people climbing St Patrick's Cathedral mm-hmm. either, and we totally recognise that.
Yeah, I mean, we said that last Friday, but I just thought, if that's the lead news story, is the opposition's yep. attacking the government for not turning up to an event, when there's so many other public policy issues for discussion, and it's the opposition's role to hold the government to account and to challenge them and to have a contest of ideas, when that's the idea, you didn't turn up to an event, when that's the big idea being pushed by the opposition, no wonder people are criticising Anthony Albanese and Co for being a bit lacklustre.
Well, I think that the public have got a very good sense of these things and can evaluate that sort of an interchange, you know, for themselves. I don't think there's a big problem there.
Well, I'd hope so, but I just listened to it and I thought, why is this the lead news story? And it might be the fault of our news service, I'm not sure, but why is this a lead news story for 2 hours straight on a Monday afternoon? Well, we're just about there for the day. Leo's getting all set up next door for another cracking edition of Food for Thought, sans Liz, for the same reason as to why she's not here with us. But if you're listening, Liz, we wish you all the best and hopefully you'll get well soon. Do you have a final word for us, Vic?
Yes, I do. Liz, get well. And the final word is, folks, if you feel strongly about this horse thing, if you feel strongly about the whole problem with thoroughbreds and the industry at large, lodge your protest by just placing a $1 bet on the Melbourne Cup. That's visible. Even those that don't bet can do it. Send the message loud and clear to the racing authorities. They are actually under the clock, and they have to perform.
Vic, thank you very much. It's time for the midday news.